Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, Colorado State University professor Ann Little examines the clothing worn by some colonial American women, with a focus on stays, which are similar to corsets. Both male and female children of the time wore stays until around the age of 7, when males would stop wearing them, while females would continue to wear them throughout their adult lives. This class is 40 minutes.
All right, the topic of today's lecture is a pair of stays, and this is to serve as an introduction to our new unit in History 358 on material culture. And this is to also serve as an introduction to the book that you'll be reading and we'll be discussing in class over the next few weeks by Marla Miller, The Needle's Eye. Today we're going to be talking about, some of this is going to be review for you all. We're going to be talking about, again, what is material culture as opposed to traditional historical sources. We'll talk a little bit about why it might be especially valuable for women's historians, especially women's historians in this the period of this class, before 1800. And then finally, I'm going to give you a lot of pictures and images to think about the ways in which we can see stays, which is a personal undergarment, as a means of understanding early American women's lives. So, briefly speaking, what is material culture? It's pretty much any object, artifact, image, painting, drawing, tool, piece of furniture, anything for our purposes, but a textual primary source, anything except something written down. So, and as we talked about before, fine art and everyday objects both qualify for as material culture. So as we discussed before, material culture is not just the fine art objects, the finely wrought Newport and Philadelphia chests you might find at the Denver Art Museum, not just the portraits of famous colonial Americans by Copley, but it also includes furniture and housewares, and not even high style, not even especially fine furniture and housewares, but just everyday objects, such as tools and equipment, stuff that would have been used in people's kitchens and households, stuff that would have been used in their gardens and their fields. Sacred and devotional objects is another important form of material culture that historians can use. You might find especially high-style sacred and devotional objects, as in the Denver Art Museum, in the particular section of the museum, their colonial Mexico section. You'll find sacred and devotional objects that are made of silver and of gold, you know, that are very finely wrought. But even just everyday sacred objects serve as important sources for material culture for historians. Clothing and personal items, if it manages to exist for a couple hundred years, which is kind of remarkable given the fact that most clothing, of course, is made out of plant fibers or animal fibers and they deteriorate fairly rapidly. And that's one of the objects in material culture we'll be talking about today, is a piece of clothing or a personal item. But in getting sort of close to the human body, we shouldn't forget that the built environment, that built structures, and other physical evidence of human habitation is also an important form of material culture for us to consider. There's kind of an interesting new movement that I think literary scholars in particular have pioneered, which is they've started looking at texts themselves, at traditional historical sources, manuscripts, diaries, letters, chapbooks, commonplace books. Some scholars, as I said, in particular literary scholars, are looking at text as material objects, the ways that they're written. Do they include sketches and other sort of marginal details? The paper that's used, the ink that the author chose, handwriting styles. So sometimes, in some, you know, especially creative ways, you can look at historical texts themselves as material objects. They can be analyzed as material objects. So are there any questions about this so far? Is there anything that I've left out? I was just trying to come up with a little review for you all. No? Okay. So why might material culture be especially useful when we're thinking about women's history as we are in this class? Well, again, as we discussed, women do not, especially before 1800, they are not the major generators of the primary sources that traditional historians use. They are not generating as many textual primary sources as men. And it's not just a matter of a differential in published records versus unpublished records, or published sources versus unpublished sources. Women are also much less likely to be the authors of the manuscript sources that we find in early American libraries and archives. And this is also true, of course, as we've talked about through this class, when we think about race and class, right? Non-white people are much, much less likely to have written traditional historical documents preserved, even about them, let alone by them, in early American archives. And poor people, of course, have less education and less access to social capital, the kind of social capital that, for example, gets you family members and other people interested in preserving your papers and putting them in libraries in the first place, right? Material culture also, I think, is something we should consider in particular in women's history, because history museums and house museums, like the Fort Collins Museum and some of the house museums we have in town, they've conserved a lot more objects on balance that were used by women for their work, or that were owned by women, that were used in their everyday lives. So relatively speaking, I mean, this is especially true in sort of state and local historical museums, historical societies, house museums. There's a lot of really wonderful primary source material culture evidence out there for women's historians to consider. And relatively speaking, there's a lot more of it that it was used or owned by women compared to the numbers of documents that are in traditional historical archives that were written by women and preserved. This is true perhaps more of modern women's history, of history since 1800 or so. But material objects are also a useful historical source that creative historians have used in creating a whole literature about women both as producers of material objects, of material goods. And that's in part what Marla Miller's book, The Needle's Eye, that we'll be reading for class discussion on Wednesday, that's in part what her book is about. But also, there's a substantial literature, especially in the modern era, about women as consumers. So this is another way that historians have used material objects to get at women's lives and experiences. Any questions so far? Okay. So today I want to talk to you about a pair of stays. Do any of you know what a pair of stays is or was? It's not a common household object or personal garment anymore. Katie?
It wasn't exactly like a corset, but it would kind of like, and you wore it as an undergarment, it would kind of like hold you in almost.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly it. And you can kind of tell, this is a pair of stays that were created to be worn by a child. It's a garment that goes around your torso, around your midsection. It's usually a little shorter than what we think of as a 19th century corset, right, which is meant to emphasize a bust and then a narrow waist and then a larger behind, right? Stays were really meant to kind of just compress everything in the torso area. And they were never worn as tight as 19th century corsets come to be worn. But Katie's exactly right. So that's what stays are. And we might think of stays in particular as garments that women wore, which they were. But I was interested to learn several years ago that children wore stays. And that in fact, all children in colonial British America, I should say all free children in colonial British America, were clapped into these stays from infancy. And girls, of course, wore them the rest of their lives, not the same pair, obviously. I think you have to sort of size up as the child's body grew. But boys would only wear stays until about age 6 or 7, right? Right around the time that boys would take off the gowns that children wore, the sort of sexless children's gowns that they wore, and put on trousers. And right about the time that Anglo-American children would be expected to acquire some form of literacy. So if they were going off to a dame school or whatever, about this age. And you know, it's very similar to the rite of passage of going off to kindergarten or first grade now, right? You know, most of you probably started kindergarten and first grade right around 6 or 7. So what do you think this says about childhood in colonial British America? Yes, Jane.
I thought they were kind of seen as like miniature adults, that, you know, they weren't seen as like little children who couldn't, you know, understand, but they were seen as like little adults that kind of forced them into that, so they kind of grow up into it, not as seen as like innocents.
Yes, yeah, I think it does reflect a sensibility of, well, you might say on the one hand, maybe in a positive light, not patronizing children, right? Having expectations of them just as you would have expectations of an adult. But you said forcing them. That was an interesting word. What would you think of a parent who sort of slap stays around their child now in modern times? Yeah, Cassie.
Well, out of curiosity, were they meant for posture to like keep them upright? So I would think that it would be a very strict household where like etiquette was thought to be of the utmost importance, so posture mattered.
They do provide some support for the core, right? If you guys do Pilates or yoga, you know about the core. They do provide some support for the core and a little bit of sort of direction for posture. At least that was the main idea, I think. So you're thinking that it would be a household that was particularly concerned about propriety? Yeah, I think that's true. Yes, Laura.
I was just thinking if they were wearing them at a young age, like they're not really, wouldn't really play like children would now. They wouldn't be able to like run around. They'd be a bit constricted in their movements maybe.
You know, I think that's what a lot of modern people might assume, is that this is a vision of childhood in which sort of control and discipline are paramount, right? This is a vision of childhood that is really about kind of taming the essentially sinful nature of humanity, right? And we're going to start in infancy. We're going to beat the civilization into them. We're going to force it into their little bodies with stays. Yeah, I think that's how I reacted anyway. And I think there are a lot of cultural resonances that I think make that a legitimate analysis of stays. But as I learned in the course of researching this kind of material object, stays played a really much more complicated role in colonial British America, as I hope to show you here in this lecture. Now, did any of you see this historical undergarment that made the front page of the news this summer? Does this look familiar to some of you? You didn't hear about the 600-year-old bra? Oh, this is like the biggest news story for me this summer. And when I saw this, and this is a bra that was discovered by Beatrix Nutz at the University of Innsbruck. She discovered it in 2008, but I guess the scholarly paper, wasn't published until a couple of years later, and then I guess this gained worldwide fame when she appeared in a documentary for the BBC. In any case, this is a linen bra that she found sort of stuffed into the wall of an old castle in Austria. And when I saw a picture of this in the newspaper, my first thought was not, oh, that's a 600-year-old bra, or that's a historical undergarment. My first thought is, oh, Jean-Paul Gaultier is making his famously deconstructed and, you know, marvelously reconstructed bras for women again. Here, this is an example. That's the designer there, the kind of bald-headed guy in the upper right. And here's an example of some of his sort of fantastical corsets and bras that he makes for women. He was the person who was made famous in part by Madonna adopting his very famous, highly structured bras in her performances in the late 80s and the early 1990s. But in any case, there are a lot of historical undergarments like stays that do not look nearly as familiar as the 600-year-old bra, which looks actually strikingly similar to garments that many of you are wearing today, I'm assuming. So anyway, to return to children's stays, as you can see, or as I hope you can see a little bit here, these are fairly crude, a fairly crude design and construction. They're made of cardboard covered with linen, and the linen is kind of crudely glued and stitched around both the inside and the outside of the cardboard. This is probably the front of the stays. And here, the stays would be laced in the back, and they would be tightened every morning by an older sister or a parent for the child who was being put into them. Now, stays, it's important to understand, stays are not like the 600-year-old bra, which might have been worn like we wear bras today, right next to the skin, right close to the body. Stays are close to the body, but they are not directly on the skin, because as, this is an image of stays for grown-ups, which you can see sort of are a little bit bigger. These are a little bit more sophisticated in their design and execution. These are likely made of a stiff canvas, stiffened by these whalebone or wooden inserts to create a fairly stiff but a little bit more flexible garment than the cardboard children's stays. So I'll show you how these would be worn. This is a modern reproduction of a late 18th century design for stays. As you can see, the stays would be worn on top of the shift. Women and men both wore either shirts in the case of men or shifts, they were called in women, which is basically a long sort of not very sophisticated nightgown type garment. And that served as kind of a combination of nightwear and underpants for people. Men would tuck their long shirt tails down in their pants, and that would kind of perform the function of shorts today. And women, as you can see here, would put their stays on top of their shifts or shirts. So that layer would be the layer closest to the skin, and then the shift would be laced and tightened around the torso on top. Any questions? Okay. Now, this was all in aid of the production of the ideal female torso that really dominated the early modern period. And this is an image that I believe I've shown you in class before. It's a portrait of Elizabeth I, the famous Ditchley portrait, in which her entire body sort of looms over her realm here, right? Over all of England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. And her toes are pointing to the town in Oxfordshire where she was born. In any case, you can see here, I think I've got a laser pointer, yeah, you can see here the classic inverted triangle, which dominates the ideal for women's shapeliness in the early modern period. So it looks like, you know, you're wider on top, narrowing down to a very narrow waist. And this is a shape that, although in the 18th century in Europe, breasts come to be highlighted more, this is a shape with very much a flat chest. There's no push-up bra effect that you get from stays, right? They're kind of clapped on top, and they're meant to compress the torso and create this nice, flat, inverted triangle. Although breasts come to be highlighted more in European representations of women, especially French representations of women, in colonial British America, this is the shape that dominates through the 18th century. So you saw in the previous image from 1592, here's Queen Elizabeth, of course, in the finest and latest of fashions for the late 16th century. But we see a very similar sort of basic design in this image of Hannah Babcock from 170 years later, where you've got the wider torso at the top coming down to a narrower waist here. And once again, it's a very flat chest. Fashions change in the 17th century to the 18th century about how much skin is visible on top. Sometimes more skin is visible on the chest, sometimes less skin and more sort of kerchiefs. But breasts are, generally speaking, held together with that compression of the stays. This is another image that shows both, I believe, a mother and a child wearing stays. This is from 1674. You can't see it so well on Elizabeth Freke. You can get a little bit of that sense of the narrowed waist there, the way that the artist has sort of created that little dip in how he painted her apron. But as you can see, the baby is portrayed as sitting up awfully straight for a little infant. And in fact, I think this might have been a posthumous portrait of the baby. This baby, I can't quite remember. I think this baby died, and this was painted after the fact. So this is truly a representation of an ideal of an early American baby. Very unusual, because children were not the subject of portraits very often at all before the 18th century, and they're still pretty uncommon until the turn of the 19th century or so. But again, baby Mary, if she did in fact survive, would have been one of the children, because as a girl child, she would have worn stays from infancy through the rest of her life. So stays were very much about gender, but they're also about age, right? If boys are wearing stays, and boys are expected to wear stays, up until about age 6 or 7, up until they were breeched, literally putting on their breeches. So stays are not just about gender, but they're also about age and stage in life. Just to remind you of this, what we're talking about here. I came across these stays because I'm researching a book right now that's a study about an individual woman. But a number of my chapters are about her childhood. She has a very eventful childhood because she's an English girl growing up on the fringes of English settlement in New England, who's taken captive by Wabanaki Indians, just like Elizabeth Hanson and her family were. And she ends up living with the Indians for several years, and then she ends up moving into a convent in Quebec City where she stays the rest of her life and becomes a choir nun. So my thought was that I could learn a lot maybe about her childhood, because of course children, even less than Anglo-American women, you know, they're not writing as many historical documents. I think we can maybe learn a lot about children's and women's lives by thinking about stays. Caroline?
Were the stays for boys and girls, were they different, or were they both that same model?
There aren't that many stays that survive. But so far as we know, so far as I know anyway, they were identical. Because, of course, they're not being worn by girls with growing breasts, right? I think the more sort of finely made shaped ones that are made more clearly for a female torso, those would not have been appropriate for little boys and girls. I think maybe these more crudely designed ones probably serve for both boys and girls. That would be my assumption, although I don't know for sure. Yes, Tia.
They might be like tightened in the morning. Does that mean that they slept in these? The children?
No. That's a really good question. Stays were generally removed at night, and people would just then sleep in that shift or that undershirt that they wore all the time. All right. I think I've got another image of children here. Here you can see this is an example of a little boy on the left and a little girl on the right. And they are, they're of the age at which I believe the little boy would still have been wearing stays, because he is not breeched, right? He's not put on his breeches yet. He's wearing a gown designed for children. And do you remember why they put children in sort of open gowns like this? Do you remember the convenience or the cleanliness arguments for this? Think about children maybe a little bit younger than these children look. Yes, Katie.
Wasn't it because they weren't like wearing and changing diapers, and so open gowns they can?
Yeah. I think it made potty training a lot easier. You know, we can't call it toilet training, of course, in the 18th century, but yes, learning sort of bladder control and the like was probably made for a lot less laundry for the servants in their household. For the enslaved women who may have done the laundry for white families and for their mothers as well. But of course, when we consider the issue of stays, we also have to think about the people who didn't wear stays in colonial British America. And so far as I've been able to tell with my research, enslaved women were never given stays. So we can think about stays in the way that we think about corsets as this technology that is about disciplining female bodies in particular, right? And even subjecting them to discomfort, pressure. Again, stays are not quite as wickedly distorting as 19th century corsets. But nevertheless, we could look at it from this perspective. But I think we should also look at it from the perspective that stays were a form of privilege in colonial British America. That having a body shaped by stays, conforming to that ideal of broad shoulders and a narrower waist, that this was a mark of racial and class privilege in colonial British America. Now, we've looked at this image before by an unknown artist in 1670. This image that shows both men and women processing tobacco in early Virginia or coastal North Carolina. And you see enslaved people at various different tasks, but not a one of them is wearing anything on top, women included. I believe this is a woman here, this is a woman here, and this is a woman over here. None of them is wearing anything on top, and they're certainly not wearing any stays. And this becomes, as we read about a few weeks ago in Jennifer Morgan's book, this becomes a trope for the representation of African and African American women's bodies. That it is okay not only for them not to wear stays, but it's okay for artists to represent them as topless or showing their breasts in some respect. Now, most enslaved women, certainly by the 18th century, were wearing some crude form of clothing. We don't know if the enslaved people in this image chose to go topless because of heat and humidity, or if that's all the clothes that they were given. We don't know. But nevertheless, black women were never given stays, and it was okay, artists thought it was okay, to represent their bodies half naked. Now, we've talked about this image in particular before, earlier in the semester when we read Jennifer Morgan's book. This is the famous image about the revolt in Suriname in the 1770s, from which sketches were generated and then engraved by William Blake, the English poet. Now, I've learned recently that this series of images were meant to be images supportive of abolition, the abolition of slavery, and that Blake himself was an abolitionist. But as we discussed in class, this is an image that can be read in many different ways, right? This is an image that clearly is meaning to eroticize the black body as it's being tortured here. This is a woman who apparently was a conspirator in the slave revolt, and she's being hung up by her wrists, and presumably so that she can be whipped and tortured by the people coming after her. But again, think about the prominence of her bust line compared to the very flat, minimal representations of free women's torsos. Yes, Laura.
Wouldn't the stays be very constricting for the women as well if they were actually slaves and working a lot? Surely if they wore them, they wouldn't be able to move as freely as they would without them.
You know, I think that's a really interesting point to consider. Maybe it's because of the sort of torso controlling technology that I've grown up with. But I also think that it might be true that wearing stays on top of a shift actually gave women that it was easier to work that way than to have, you know, breasts moving around and getting in your way and, you know, flopping all over the place. Yes, Trish.
Did freed female slaves, did they adopt the stays once they gained freedom?
You know, that's something I really have to look into. I don't know the answer to that, but my guess would be yes. Because we know that, for example, in those documents that we read from the Wells, Maine Congregational Church baptismal records, we know that free black families, or people who look like they were free black families, they were taking their children in for baptism. They were engaging in these other rituals of colonial Anglo-American life. So I'm guessing that they probably would have wanted to have a presentation as a free woman. And I'm kind of wondering if the mark of slavery, one of the marks of slavery, was having a kind of an undisciplined or uncontrolled torso, a torso that did not conform to that early modern ideal that Anglo-American women absolutely insisted on. But yeah, no, I think you're asking really excellent questions. I haven't done enough research to answer those questions yet, but I think it's important to think about, what did it mean for a female body not to be contained by stays? What message did that signal? to the rest of colonial Americans. This is just another image. I think I've shown you this one before. Bare-breasted African and Afro-American women were used to advertise all kinds of things, right? This is a label for a tobacco company. And it's decorated by bare-breasted women here on the left. It was not considered risque or shameful to show pictures of bare-breasted Afro-American women. It's interesting, too, that the images we have of African women, if you think about it, they're bare-breasted women are being sort of disciplined, they're being punished, or they're portrayed as workers, right? They're carrying their hoes, they're shouldering their hoes here in this image. Keep that in mind here. Because, of course, we have other images of women in colonial America who also are topless, and they are Native American women. It's okay, too, for European and Euro-American artists to portray Native women as topless. However, the images of Native women here, this is the image of that John White, this is part of that famous series of watercolors from the Roanoke expedition around 1585. And then here, almost 200 years later, a very similar image on the right, labeled Sauvagesse Iroquoise by Jacques Grasset de Saint-Sauveur in 1796. They're really striking to me in their maternalism, right? That the point of showing the bare-breasted women, or even maybe perhaps a nursing woman, you know, the woman holding the cradle board, maybe the excuse was to portray women, Native women, as mothers, or portray them as the caregivers to young children. But if you recall, the image of African and Afro-American women, they're portrayed as workers or as victims of discipline and punishment. But the Native American women are portrayed as mothers. But of course, we know from our reading and discussion of Jennifer Morgan's book, are those African women likely mothers as well? Yeah, absolutely they are. And just to conclude here with a final image, this is a famous piece of propaganda from the American Revolution. This is the Able Doctor, or America Swallowing the Bitter Draft, from the London Magazine, published in May of 1774. And this is a portrayal, once again, of a comely, high-breasted Native American woman who is meant to represent America. She is the metaphor for America. And the villains who are holding her down, pouring scalding tea down her throat, and looking up the drape over her lower section, the villains are various representatives of British law and authority, with a kind of a smirking and laughing Spaniard and Frenchman looking on here. There's another woman in this image. What do you notice about, about Britannia? The other woman is Britannia. What do you notice about Britannia in contrast to America? Yeah, Tia.
She's turning her face away and she's covering her eyes as if, like, it's something that women should never see, is, like, that type of state as well.
And this kind of humiliation and torture of America.
Like, I even noticed that, like, she is even, like, even though she's wearing more clothing, she's still, the cut is extremely low and very, like, drapery instead of like an actual fitted gown that we've been seeing.
Yes, yeah. She is wearing clothing, whereas America is there in all of her lovely full-breasted glory. I think that's an excellent point. But yes, and she's turning her head in shame, but I think it's highly significant that the European woman, the woman meant to represent Europe, meant as this embodiment of Britain, Britannia, she is fully clothed, whereas America is the Native American with bare breasts. This was the letter in this man's pocket says the Boston Port Bill. This is after Britain cracks down on the Boston Tea Party of December of 1773, and they pass laws saying that colonial Americans have to buy and drink the tea from the British East India Company. And so that's why America is in part being subjected to, the torture she's being subjected to is having to drink the, as it says, the bitter draft of tea. So, are there any questions about stays so far? Yes, Meg.
What's the relationship between stays and breastfeeding?
You know, that's a great question. Meg asked what the relationship was between stays and breastfeeding, because you would wonder, how's that going to happen? And it was funny, I gave a version of this talk at a conference this summer, and it was really well attended, and one of the people there, a friend of mine, what used to be a reenactor at Plymouth Plantation, and I asked her about this, because this is one of the questions I had too, and she said that she can't remember. She was actually nursing her daughter while she was a reenactor at Plymouth Plantation and while she was being laced into stays for her reenacting, you know, the life of an early, you know, English pilgrim. And she said she can't really remember how she did it, that she either sort of pushed them down so that she could breastfeed from the top, or somehow she got the baby underneath them. They got loose enough and she sort of tucked the baby up under her shift. But that somehow she did it, but she couldn't exactly remember how. But it does happen, yes. Obviously, it had to happen, right? At least every once in a while. Yeah. Any other questions about stays? Jade, did you have a question?
I was just going to ask you if you knew if the stays were worn over something else as opposed to the 600-year-old bra you showed us? And do you think that's because since it was made out of cardboard and other such materials like that, that it wouldn't be easy to clean? And so you would want to wear something underneath of it so you didn't get sweat and it would smell bad?
That's exactly why they wore the shifts underneath. The stays were not meant to be laundered and washed all the time. But they were, generally speaking, covered with some kind of gown or short gown or something on top. They were not like Jean-Paul Gaultier's bra, right, and Madonna and her cone bras. They were not meant to be worn on top of, you know, as part of the decorative element of the costume. They were definitely meant to be worn concealed under a gown for children and for women. So that they were encased on both sides, protected from sweat on the body and dirt on the body, and also protected from dirt and filth from the outside. So, if there are no more questions, I'll just conclude this lecture talking about what I've learned. So, contrary to my original expectations when I first saw that picture of those children's stays, stays are not just about gender and age, but they're also about race and class as well. Because stays were worn by all free infants and children to about age 7. Stays were also worn by free girls and women from infancy until death. But again, as I suggested in my lecture, I think it's important to think about the women who were not wearing stays, either because their masters chose not to give them stays to wear, or because they themselves chose not to adopt stays. So enslaved women and Native American women never adopted stays, generally speaking. And I need to look into the question, I believe it was Trish's question perhaps, about the question of free black women and what were they wearing in this period. So therefore, stays, I think, when we look at this particular object, this humble object of everyday material culture, it turns out they're actually a pretty important means by which colonial society drew all kinds of boundaries. Age boundaries, gender boundaries, and race boundaries, ethnic boundaries. Any questions? All right. Thanks very much.
Next week on Lectures in History, Craig Shirley, author of 2 books on Ronald Reagan, guest lectures at President Reagan's alma mater, Eureka College in Illinois. Mr. Shirley discusses the career and political campaigns of the nation's 40th president. Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in history are also available as podcasts. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcasts or download them from iTunes.